Hi, everybody. We're going to begin in just a minute, so you can casually take your seats. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Okay, welcome back for part two of our very full weekend of offerings. As a way to begin, and I hope everyone will forgive me, and I hope it's helpful to those presenting. Some of you know I'm a musician in real life, and so I am going to give a brief lesson on microphone usage. We are live streaming to WJXC, and although this is an intimate space and it may feel like everyone can hear you, if you're not speaking directly into the mic, you are not being heard by most people. So here's how it works. The microphone has to point at your mouth. You can't speak over it like an ice cream cone. It should point at your mouth. Imagine that it is a baby spoon and someone is saying choo-choo and food is coming to your mouth. Ideally, you are one hand's width away or closer. I'm able to adjust the volume, but if you're farther away from one expanded hand's width, you're too far away, which means I have to crank the mic up as far as possible and the speakers will start squealing, which is why we heard some squeaky sounds earlier, because I was cranking the microphones up so very, very, very high. But we're amazing who spoke this morning. And we're also gonna do our best to keep the front door closed so the air conditioning can do its job. And I so appreciate everyone being here and being so wonderfully on time and giving such amazing presentations. So now, without further ado, I am going to, I don't have to, what did I do before with Joan Retallack? I don't have to channel Mark Novak. I can actually simply invite him up here.
I feel there's a lot of microphone pressure after that that presentation. But I'm totally analog, so hey, everybody. Welcome back. I hope you had a good lunch. First of all, I want to say how great it is to be at this space and to thank Jeffrey. During the height of COVID, I live here in Columbia County, when not much literary stuff was happening, the Worker Writer School, which I run workshops for workers in New York City and all over, came out with a book from our Zoom workshops called Coronavirus Haiku, and we did a streaming film of those haiku. And on May Day, at the height of COVID, Jeffrey had gotten a great projector from the Hudson Opera House that was upstairs and ran every night for a couple of weeks our streaming haiku on a building that used to be across the street. So thank you for that. It was like a real kind of refuge, artistic refuge during that time. I want to talk about this idea really briefly of kind of, I guess, pluralizing the notion of the New York school to New York schools. New York is not a city, but a state. I'm from Buffalo, lived in Rochester, live here in Columbia County, live in New York City. And so, I don't know, 15 years ago, I fell in love with this book called Betcha Ain't, Poems from Attica. 6 months after the Attica uprising, also in New York State in 1971, so early in 72, this poet who's on the back, Celeste Tisdale, was asked to start poetry workshops at Attica. He lived in Buffalo, New York. He was a professor at Erie Community College, where I also went. He was not my professor. And this collection of poems and his journals came out in 1974 from Broadside Press in Detroit, Dudley Randall's Press, and has been out of print maybe for 20 years. And I adored this book, and I couldn't find Celeste anywhere. I wrote about this book in this one book called Organize Your Own, an art exhibit catalog. I wrote about it again in my own book, Social Poetics. And when that book was coming out, I got a phone call from Celeste. Someone had given him my number. And we talked. He had moved to Georgia, which explains why I couldn't find him in New York. And I said, this book is so important to me. I feel like it's a time that it could really speak to a brand new audience. And he was like, we should try to get it reprinted and I can help you with that. And he said, oh, those aren't all the poems from the workshop. I have a box in my closet of poems and journals, et cetera, et cetera. So during the COVID period, we worked together to put together an expanded edition of the book, and it just came out last year from Duke University Press. It's now called When the Smoke Cleared, Attica Prison Poems and Journal. From Duke, grab a copy. If you want to read my introduction, it's there online. You can just download the PDF at their website. And we've been doing lots of events around the book in New York City, a bunch of them coming up in Buffalo, et cetera, et cetera. But what I want to talk about is at this same time in the mid-1970s, that there was this kind of incredible interest in poetry at Attica and in prisons across the United States. So that this was not the only book in which poets got together, studied poetry, and wrote, but there was an incredible amount of work that came out. So one of them that came out at the same time was this book, also by a New York Stater, Joe Bruchock, who lives in the Adirondacks. A few people may know his work. This was called The Last Stop, Writing from Comstock Prison. Another great anthology from the New York School of Poets of the 1970s. And it opens with this amazing poem by a writer named A. Jabbar. And I asked Joe when I interviewed him, I was like, how out of the workshop did you get this incredible poem from this poet? Like, who were you using as model poems? Who, you know, what were you talking about? How were you editing it? And Joe said to me, you know, these were people in my workshop who had survived the Attica uprising, and this person and others literally were recovering from bullet wounds from the troopers who had come into Attica firing, and I didn't need to coax them to what to write about. They had everything to write about. And so I have this essay coming out in a book where I look at all these other publications I've been able to find from Attica and elsewhere, but particularly Attica for today. And so there was a newspaper printed by those who were at Attica called Attica News. Almost every single issue of the newspaper includes poetry. Poetry was a vital mode of communication to everyone. I have a number of them. I only brought one of them. Prisoner defense funds organized and put out buttons and pins, pamphlets, other material. They also put out things like this chapbook called Awakening of a Dragon from Attica Brother Jomo, which has a number of poems in them. Always poetry plays a role in this work. And so I'm just going to say a few words to end about this last one. So Celeste was there from 72 to 74, beginning of 75. Someone else was there briefly. And then another poet named Gerald Schwartz came and taught a poetry workshop. And he started this small press while he was there called La Huerta Press. These books are almost impossible to find. I only have it because he sent it to me. But this is a chapbook by someone who is in his workshop that he tried to get that work out, named Antu Satya, a pen name. And it's called Convicted Voices. And I know one of the things about the New York School, you know, is a lot on this kind of changing mechanism of print and print culture. Like if you think about The Secret Location from the Lower East Side and books like that, right? And so I asked Gerald how he got this book printed. And he said he was living in Rochester and teaching at BOCES. With students, and that the BOCES students laid out and printed this, right? And again, just an incredible book of poems. And so I'm just going to read two or three paragraphs to conclude from this essay that's coming out about all this ephemera from Attica, that's particularly about this last book, Convicted Voices. The final poem in Convicted Voices, Two Birds, imagines the coming both of a more temperate and symbolic spring, slightly warmer air, rebirth, and perhaps release. In the opening poem, two birds sing in harmony, quote, tones of freedom. The poem's abolition geography, to borrow a term from Ruth Wilson Gilmore, remains quite local. A sparkling day, Attica's green fields, inmates dressed in green, also in the yard, a robin flying about the gray prison walls, and crows on the rooftops where New York State troopers fired their rifles a few Septembers previous. According to Dillard, his real name, also represents unity and solidarity. And this is an excerpt from the poem. Free birds fly high by nature. You seem to be happy. Come tomorrow to the windows. My bread I will share. Unnatural in this atmosphere. Fly, my friends, fly. In the unnatural atmosphere of Attica, robins and crows and blackbirds become the representatives of freedom. Their continual return allows the poet to reimagine or to continue to imagine his freedom beyond these horrible, unmending walls of Attica. There's another poem that riffs off Robert Frost's Mending Wall, right? And it's called Unmending Wall, and so the reference there. And it's imperative to Dillard to maintain those tones of freedom in his daily life because, as he asserts in the opening poem of the chapbook, incarceration begins when a mind refuses to think. And final paragraph. A journalist who visited McCarthy's workshops at Attica nearly 7 years after the uprising, described a continuing sense of militancy in these participants' writings. Quote, the poems say and do things beyond the dictionary definitions and grammatical patterns of words. At Attica, the idea of poetry as a liberating force was clearer because the walls were tangible. Imprisoned writers at Attica, from Tisdale's workshop in the early 1970s to Gerald McCarthy's of the late 1970s, imagined, like Miriam Kaba would 4 decades later write, that it's time, quote, for a jailbreak of the imagination. And so one of the things I'm really looking at in this work, just to conclude, is the way in which the language of abolition today has this precursor in the writings of incarcerated writers in the 1970s. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thinking about what counts as experimental poetics, who counts as poets. Mark was also one of the first people to publish me when he was editing XCP, Cross-Cultural Poetics, so hooray for that. And Tracy also gave me a wonderful opportunity to honor Akila Oliver, so fabulous people in the space. I'm happy to be here. I'm gonna read some excerpts and some different things. This is the 250th anniversary of the publication of Phyllis Wheatley's collection of poems. She had one poem in which she named where she was from, And it's known as Phyllis's reply to the answer. So this is my reinscription, or an excerpt from it. When place is officially preceded by article, often it is named after a river. A river is vast until you see the ocean, the two incomparable. My soul returns your, my pen and pixels, your ink and type. Shores ever verdant in memory of spontaneous soil. The rebellion, which soul returns. You're our black, you're our femaleness, you're our art. Riddle, where on earth is night eternal? Nowhere, Phyllis, where minds shine, even if their brilliance is shuttered in. An answer is a reply, sometime solution to the problem didn't know you have. On the occasion of the umpteenth declaration of genius, magic, tomfoolery, betrayal, you're poised, writing your way out. This is an excerpt from a poem called La Jablesse in Oakland. He stand up watching me. And when I finish, he turn around and slash with the machete. Leave? He lean into my face, laughing. Leave now. I had to bind me on foot. But when my foot heal, I go and stand up in a road where I know he must pass me coming back from whichever rum shop or jamet he keeping house with now. It's train tracks on the one side and forest on the other, and who running in forest after dark? And as he get closer to me, and he know it me, I start walking. Not good because I'm not too used to the club foot yet. And I smile. For I know if ever will could do anything, my will going to kill this man. And I limp in and smile in. And how the conductor didn't hear me don't know, because everyone in the parish that night wondering what obia thing cause a goat neck to be slit so slow that it screams so long. But he soon stopped, and as people piece together the body, they piece together a story of what happened. They call me La Jablesse, devil woman. The woman them too bad talk me in the street, but when nightfall they come try mackle me with sweet tamarind and cloth no one will sell me in the store. Bless, they say, for then they say I am blessed. Bless, this man does treat me bad, bad. You can't do him something for me? What I gonna say? May I have no money? They treat me like I is kill priest in town. I say, go see what I could do. Is all your own fear and longing and hate that is give me power? Is all you make me a real La Jablesse? And this last one that I will read is called Avant-Garde is a Term of War, written for Jane Cortez. The safety is off. We have to laugh. Safety's always off. War begins at home. D.V., we are the cavalry. Even in war, laughter. Lip-licking, even in war. Fried dough, pepper-dished. We are cavalry. We, avant-garde, front line. Troops facing down, torches, shots, spit, tossed coffee, we, the avant-garde, taking direct hits, and we, the cavalry, wounds salted with unsalted butter, hate sucked and spit out by the same mouth, reminding us our skin is velvet, we gorgeous, not hidden, not buried. Thank you.
I have too much on this PowerPoint. I'm going to go kind of fast, but I'm also going to let you all know that this has got a lot of good live links. And if you're interested in Tom and his work, if you put your email on here, I will send you the PowerPoint. And then you can click on the links, and you can just go, okay? So we mentioned that the New York School is not just the people that got named that way, ironically, to rhyme with the painters, but also those who were in New York having to do with spreading the word of poetry. And I'm going to talk about the poet Tom Weatherly. There's a bio on here, a whole page of bio. What's worth really mentioning here is that although born in Scottsboro, Alabama, and died in Huntsville, just to the west in his late mother's house, he spent most of his adult life after serving in the U.S. Marines, and my son tells me he heard tales of the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, came to New York in 68, didn't leave till sometime around 2012, published an anthology for a workshop that he led in East Harlem in 68, hung around Umbra and Cave Canem, hung a lot around St. Mark's with Joel Oppenheimer's groups, knew the New York School poets. I met him with Eugene Ritchie at David Ignato's seminar for the MFA at Columbia in 74. He had three books right away in the early 70s and then a 30-year hiatus until he kindly let us publish this book, which I have the last 10 copies of sitting here, and if someone would be interested in purchasing them, I'm the publisher as soon as they sell out and I can print more. He taught all over, including Poets in the Schools and at Rikers, the community there. He worked at the important literary pub called Lion's Head, known as The Head, and then 30 years at the Strand, where he skimmed off the best of the incoming collections, and which is why you see him in that photograph. That's his apartment, which was set up with library stacks and a bicycle hanging from the ceiling. Until finally he got rid of all the books and went down to Scottsboro. His important innovations, and what I want to talk about quickly, are the invention of some forms, including the glory and the ex-glory, his experiments with early computer word processing and various programs, especially with synesthesic uses of color and sound, his blues patterning, which there's one poem here on this PowerPoint and a lot more in the book, and he blogged. Of those blogs that he had, and he had at least three that I know of, one remains still accessible, which he called Eclectic Git, and he ran for 8 years from 05 to January 2013. Are we good? The pattern of the ex-glory is here in this poem, Music. They're brief, but they don't have to be because they go on for stanza after stanza. But the ex-glory stanza has a pattern that runs in terms of consonant and vowel in an X from upper left down through the center to lower right and back from upper right down through the center to lower left. I will read this and then I will show you the pattern. Music, bluesy, subtle, bluest, thence, beauty blooms, sunlit bluets, center whence, brutal musics, humans vent as blues. So you can see from the upper, the blue, first syllable, first line, bu, second syllable, second line, blue again, middle syllable, middle line, musics, second to last syllable, fourth line, and blues. Cornerstoning out as you leave the poem. And the same thing happens through moving in the other direction. Okay, bluest, and then the beauty, then the blue again in the middle, the brutal, and then the humans, taking the sound back out the other way. He was committed to Courier, the typewriter font, because he could line it up on a grid. And he used it all the time the way a musician uses individual notes of music to create a melody as units of composition. And he adored word processors, as you can see from some of the games that he would play here and send to everybody on his mailing list. This is the poem Simple Honest Speech. Rare in public, rare in private. He's using the international linguistic sound alphabet thing whose name I'm blocking. Thank you. That's it. He's using the international phonetic alphabet and color to show the movement of his sound thoughts. Okay, so I'm not going to pause here. There are two links on the bottom where you can get yourself this on your computer screen, plus the eulogy, the obituary for the woman to whom he dedicated this. And every poem is for somebody. Every poem is about and for somebody. Here he is again, in a very classic pose. Couple more poems, couple more color breakdowns. A thing he says here, worth reading. Only the vowels are colored, as always. I can't see the tiny type here, and if I say this, I go away from the microphone. He says, what matters of this? I don't write rhetorical flourish. I write music. This is one tiny piece of paper this big, front and back. And this is online, too, at Jacket 2, where they had a whole dedicated issue for him. He was a feature. He's writing to the poet and critic and dear friend of his forever, Bert Kimmelman. He says, Bert, excuse my eyeballs. Here are first installment of all. He gave Bert a bunch of these, but this is the one with the glory. Some of the poems are in a prosody that I invented. And he gives a little poem and then shows the pattern running from the upper left down to the lower right with an A. You can see it run through, okay? That's two on the back, he writes. The form's called the glory. It always has an odd number of syllables and a rhyme scheme, and then he shows you one going this way, and then he shows you one going that way, and then he shows you the X glory. And there you can see the pattern, maybe called the double glory. He gives one of these great definitions of himself that he loved to say. I am first and foremost a descendant of HD. And here he means the imagist, of the friend of the ex-girlfriend, in fact, of Ezra Pound. He adored her, skimmed all the first editions off from the Strand as they came in, and influenced by an eclectic group of poets from blues, rock, R&B, and the usual tradition from Europe, Africa, Asia, etc. You know, all that, and usual. I hope this gives you a beginning. I'm back in the world again, gives his phone number, and available for discussion and frivolity. Thomas. Here's his poem, Wally, which is a long poem that ends the short history here. And of it, Burt wrote, Wally ends short history with a grand jeté. It is in itself beautiful and is a most accomplished fugue that, like the blues in its structure, operates with a determinedly limited lexis. Weatherly is using his own form, the glory, as a basic prosody, yet underlying that is an interchangeability of words within a construct of beat and dense sonority. And here's Weatherly in 2007 at his 65th birthday with my son Joe, who was 15 at that time. This is his early book, Mau Mau American Cantos. This is him with his Strand t-shirt. And another poem worth reading aloud. You ain't safe from dying until you're dead. Preacher said so. You work your brain to bone until you're gone. Rot it in your grave or enjoy the blessings of breath until you have nothing else to do but die because you can't go on forever. Whether you're truly living or no one knows you lived and breathed and bred your mortal line in the shifting sand alongside a sea you can't control, even you were a god. There's a very strong flowchart link for Tom, if only because his name appears dead center on page 23. Number 60 in a list of 108 notable writers in John's Vermont Notebook, his collaboration with Joe Brainard from Black Sparrow in 1975, where John also lists his usual buddies along with others that you might not expect, including Bob Dylan. This is a photo of one of his dictionaries. He illuminated these things all the way through, more than one. He'd pick them up for nothing when they came into the Strand, and then he would decorate the language with colors and forms and shapes. There's one of these in Europe with an ex-wife. There's one I think that Janet might have, Janet Rosen has. There are a couple of links to the big feature on Tom done by Jacket. And there is a link to an article I wrote for Best American Poetry as an obit when we lost him. And if anyone is interested, come talk to me, and I'd be glad to sell you one of the last of these books. And I will gladly, if you have the yellow pad that's going around, send you all these links. Thank you.
Deborah Bernhardt, and earlier Tracy Morris said something about the presence of bodies and the absence of bodies, and for this reason I thought I would start with an excerpt from Citizen, Claudia Rankine's Making Room script for public fiction at Hammer Museum. And about three quarters of the way into the poem, she says, you put your body there in proximity to, adjacent to, alongside, within. You don't speak unless you are spoken to, and your body speaks to the space you fill, and you keep trying to fill it, except the space belongs to the body of the man next to you, not to you. Where he goes, the space follows him. If the man left his seat before Union Station, you would simply be a person in a seat on the train. You would cease to struggle against the unoccupied seat, where, when, why, the space won't lose its meaning. For this poem, thank you to Dennis Smith, and also thank you to them for, in this poem, in addition to nodding to Dennis Smith, I also utilize their quoting of quoting. And from Audre Lorde's Coal, singing out within the crash of passing sun. That Copperfield revealed no Statue of Liberty, audience seats stealth rotated to face nothing. Bridge, 20 volumes of ground. Give us Dennis Smith magic, bring boys back through glinting bodies inhabiting sun between damnation and damnation, between stark shine and calyx, between spaceship and kiln, between corner glass and corner glass, mitered without mullions, coroners disappearing, junctures singing and flung. For this poem, thank you to Terence Hayes. It has an epigraph from the physicist Marissa Giugustina and others, space-like separation of each local measurement from both the distant choice and the distant measurement closes the locality loophole. Incompatible local realism. Chestnut Grandison is a star walking away from the star. We read with eyes of wool. Our hero adopts the trickster stance that his independent variable does not matter. Under most circumstances, the universe obeys locality, yet the universe drops hints of being non-local at its foundations. Our foundation, as you know, has a cotton precedent. This year's trumpet inherits the birth. They came for the universe, and I did not speak effectively. Straw men emptying their faces. We were naive about the nativist electorate. Decohere, adore. For this last poem, thank you to a variety of poets, but probably especially, again, Terence Hayes. Regarding one of their chants. 18-wheeler peels my front, revealing innards unknown to me. Like a washboard honeycomb, air rectangle for laundry and bees to reject. Virginian with villains whitely descend. I'm pathetic in Craigslist, Prius and Virtue tea, cowed. Driving home, hours and hours of wary bungee cords and zip ties. Nothing leaking, nothing sparking fire. Easily rolling away, shorn to the hood, but bloodless, metallic eye rhyme with the car whose front also dangled after murdering Heather Heyer. Which is to say, I'm disgusting, writing of how I stood out for nothing. Sniveling nincompoop plunking chunks of car from the road as if I could stick them back. Shortly before Heather Hare's killer's car takes the screen of Black Klansmen, there's a Spike Lee People Mover shot of, plot spoiler, raising snub-nosed pistols, sliding a corridor, double dolly till we zoom and fall through a window into KKK fire in 2017's eye. Ectochrome of white nationalists, sharp white background thrown for me. They have another thing coming, because folks will replace them.
Giving Jeffrey Ajita. We're going to switch it up a little bit and not take a break and go ahead because we have a shorter panel than we originally planned, and this will give people a longer break between now and the show. So if the lovely panelists would like to avail themselves of seats along the perimeter of this wall. And I want to, since we have a little bit of time, I want to just set up a context for the conversation and give you guys a little bit of behind the curtain scenery. Oh my goodness, Tracy. Tracy says third personing herself like a very strange person. But I do feel like it is part of my obligation here, especially given the context, to say why we're having this panel. And, you know, besides that, we should. So, you know, I'm on the board of flow chart here. Wow, and my students are right. When I get more intense, my accent is heavier. As my Iowa students say, your accent gets heavier. I'm like, what accent? Anyhow, we talk these things out as board members, and one of the things that that we strongly agree to, and you know, it's like, why do you join boards? Is as we continue to have these gatherings, we can't whitewash the complexities and the issues around who frames poetics and poetic schools. And since oftentimes marginalized people are disappeared. It's beyond not giving credit. It's disappeared into the maw of absorption, right? It encourages a kind of gaslighting about poetry and poetics that's unhealthful and unhelpful, right? And I think if we're going to look at innovation, we need to do better than the conventional do in terms of where innovation comes from and what it means. And so this is, since we had the first gathering last year, and it was nice, it's like, well, we can't keep proceeding without engaging with these things, because otherwise it's a gathering of the old problems, and they don't need to be gathered. They don't need to continue to be gathered. They gather among themselves quite successfully. And so I just wanted to say that in this context. This is not a flourish, and this is not tokenism. This is a big reason why we're having this gathering. And I wanted you to hear that from me, not, you know, kind of coincidentally. I'm from Brooklyn, and I'm from East New York. And, yeah, see, we had a whole conversation. And one of the things that, at one point I was doing this research, Mark, had the highest recidivism rate and the highest rate of people who returned from being incarcerated and living in a place, that was East New York, where I grew up. And so there's a kind of electrifying energy that happens there, but it's also a great deal of trauma. And of course, when you talk about electrification and trauma, you gotta talk about poetry. And one of the things that hasn't been brought up here is also hip hop and its emergence during the 1970s and how transformative that was for earlier presentations of poetry and poetics, including Nikki Giovanni's collaboration with Community Mass Choir and a whole and The Last Poets and a whole bunch of other people, right? So I wanted to think about this in the, I'm setting this up as a conversation, which is, I'm being like kind of a bad moderator, but I'm wearing a couple of hats here. One is, you know, I was thinking about the framing, how, say, Amedia Baraka is framed. I know Rosamund gave shout out to Jane Cortez. black activists and choices about how black activists could serve the community as poets created these kind of existential crises where people had to decide, is the form in service? And the kind of pressure on marginalized communities to be of service because the critical need was so high is some of the things that Mark was talking about. So how, I wanna set up a few things and then you guys can take it where you want. But one of the things I think we also have to talk about in the 1970s poetry and moving forward is how the post-integrationist aesthetics and those efforts created a confounding, confusing, and conflating idea of poetics and poetic schools, and the notions of gentrification that happened in the context of this conflation. It's a very complicated thing, but it's not really that complicated, right? It's like, if you can't beat them, join them, then take their stuff and act like you created it. That's really not a long sentence, right? So what about people like Baraka who felt like he had to make that choice? What about the relationship between avant-gardeness and freedom, and also the conceit of avant-gardeness as a way of displacing its community source, its community drive? Baraka and Ashbery were only 7 years apart in age, and they have sevens in there. That's like a little cosmic. Like Mary was born on the 7th, and you know, Ashbery's born on in 27. So one of the things that comes up is like the who's New York, and the thing is, it's all about New York. The entire state, including Attica and all of these places. It's just interesting to find out like where the seams of segregation are, where the seams of integration are, and where black aesthetics fit in to this integral part of articulation. And people have talked about it with jazz. I think hip hop, it's undeniable, but also the musicality that goes from black articulated speech in English that has echoes of black articulated speech from Africa that is part of the African-American aesthetics, you know, and therefore American aesthetics. It's a lot of things at the same time. But I wanted to set it up like this because these are all deeply political things and personal things. And I think we have to figure out, I was talking with Monica and Paolo and James about this, the politics of sharing and the responsibility of sharing. And people who feel that sharing can be an empowering source when you give credit, versus those who feel like they will disappear or be disappeared or swallowed whole if they're giving credit. So I was thinking about something you were talking about, Deborah, regarding Spike Lee and Black Klansmen. I have a theory. I'm the worst moderator ever. But y'all are very generative. The theory is that had the highest section was the whole reason he made Black Klansmen. It was to put that in there. Because it was on the anniversary of Charlottesville. And he wanted to make them look like stupid, dangerous people. Stupid people, but dangerous. And that's the whole point was to make sure that Heather Heyer was not forgotten. That was Spike Lee's ethics. I really do believe that. And the question is, how do we keep being a canary in the coal mine? Because see, now everybody talking about these people are buck wild and don't know how to act and trying to destroy this whole country, right? What is the ethics of poetics? What is the ethics of sharing and care? And how do we help people survive and not just thrive? How do we remember, as Rosamond was talking about, people like Jane? These are Tom too. What are these questions and how do we negotiate them, I guess, or how are you negotiating them? It's the longest question ever.
Thing I didn't get to say. Tom, in his 40s, I guess, converted to Orthodox Judaism. It made it easier for him because he loved little Jewish girls a lot. Married at least two of them that I know of. Although his kids are from different mamas of different groups. One of the ways he negotiated sharing was he loved people, and he loved them, and he went after them, and not an ex-wife who didn't include him in the family ever after. Hmm. And all the children called him dad, and the grandchildren call him grandpa, one of their grandpas, however other many there may have been. And his daughter Regina, who is raising twins in Marietta, Georgia, and still adores the last wife, Janet, or maybe second to last, Rosen, who's in New York and is his executor, or one of them. And I learned more about Judaism from one conversation one afternoon with John than I did from an entire childhood as an Orthodox daughter in Kentucky. When he said that it's clearly the name of God, Yahweh, is the sound of breathing in and breathing out. And that's what makes it the holiest of holies. Mm. And that's all the priest had to do when he entered the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur was breathe in and then breathe out. And that called the presence of God to fill the sanctuary, which was the most a Buddhist Jewish thing also that I can imagine having as an idea in terms of breath. And he was on the Lower East Side, one of his missions, and he lived in the Hamilton Fish Houses out on Houston Street, way on out east, was to join the last of the old Jewish men in the last of the Lower East Side synagogues to make sure they all had a minyan. Sometimes he'd hit two or three of them on a Saturday morning. Because he acted on belief and thought deeply at the same time and never shut up to tell everybody what he'd figured. That's all I got to say.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
I mean, what you're saying makes me think, and also your extended question, it does make me think about community and about ethics. And I come from communities where if you say you're a poet, people say, great, give us a poem. Yeah, now, which is quite different than many of the poets I know who they say they're a poet and people kind of run away or you know, don't want to hear from them. And so I think inherently for some of us, being poets does not divide us from community from the beginning. And in fact, the community emphasizes your responsibilities to them because then they're going to tell you what they think about the poem you just read.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, oh, okay, that was nice. It's, you didn't get that right. Or that was great, or I was honored to read a poem at a birthday party/rally for Eric Garner, and this guy in the front, he said, say it again! I had to say that line until he stopped saying, say it again. Because the people were telling me what to do, right? When I think about community, I definitely think about Jane. I think about, I'm not sure if Lorenzo Thomas invited me to the reading or if Jane said she was bringing me to read with her. And before I go up, she puts her hand in her pocket and pushes something to me, and it's $50. Because Lorenzo didn't have any money, and she believed poets needed to be paid.
Mm.
So, you know, all the different ways in which we think about poetics and poetry and what it means to be part of a poetic community, I think spans, it's kind of a rambling answer, but for me it spans all of those things.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess since I'm holding it. so I guess you asked, how do we negotiate? I think for me it's a constant state of feeling very unsettled, constant reworking. It's not right, but I'm trying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess one of the things I think about is the erasure of community a lot. And so, like, I still talk to Celeste all the time. Like, we just talked this morning on the phone to switch the date of one of the Buffalo events because the Buffalo Bills are opening their season on the day he booked an event on Monday Night Football. And I'm like, nobody's going to come, right? It's Buffalo. No one will show up. But, you know, when I was, like, we were talking all the time, he just would tell these stories about, you know, like, oh, did I tell you about the time I drove Gwendolyn Brooks to Attica, right? And, like, that's nowhere in the documentation, that's nowhere in the archive, right? Like, even there are two different books about Dudley Randall and Broadside Press, which are both really good books. Celeste is mentioned as a footnote in one of them, right? Because writing in prisons didn't seem important for, it was important for a little while, right? The kind of Etheridge Knight, Jimmy Santiago Baca emergence from there into the literary canon. But there are all the, there are hundreds, thousands of other poets, right, who were writing poetry every single day, and even major events were not documented, right? So people probably know Archie Shepp's record, Attica Blues, right? Like, this phenomenal record. There's almost, like, I could find almost no documentation except for one of these additional poems and then eventually a footnote in somebody's book many years later that Archie Shepp played Attica when that record came out. Mm. He and the band performed there. And then one of the poets in the workshop wrote a poem about Archie Shepp playing at Attica. And I was like, Celeste, they let Archie Shepp play Attica Blues at the prison? And he was like, oh yeah, they came in, they just wouldn't allow it to be recorded, right? And so that intense piece of information is just, had been otherwise, like, you know, not out there anywhere. And continually in these conversations and in working on this project, there are these moments of, like, anti-erasure, I don't know what to quite call it, to try to bring these things back into the conversation. Mm. And so I think if community happens, it's a way of this process of bringing these lost pieces back into conversation. Because Celeste just celebrated his 80th birthday, right? He's not gonna be telling these stories forever, right? And I think they're incredibly important because here is, like, literally the first Black Arts Movement workshop in a prison in the United States, right? He went in with Amiri Baraka records. You know, he went, you had mentioned Baraka. He went in with Sonia Sanchez poems. You know, all these poems as models for the writers he was working with. And I just think it's an incredible history of that kind of workshops and how important they can be.
Mm.
Got it out there now.
Yeah.
But little by little, yes. But there's so much of it. I mean, literally, like, this Joe Bruchak, who I mentioned, like, he has edited up in the Adirondacks countless numbers of these anthologies and books from imprisoned writers. He, like, I talked to him, we brought him down to an event here in New Lebanon in the county for the Worker Writer School, and he told us he had taught in prisons in 35 different states around the country, right? And so this work is, like, out there, but it's in little small archives in, you know, libraries of certain universities, but it's inaccessible to most of us, and I feel like that accessibility is incredibly important if we're going to move these kind of conversations forward.
Yeah. Wow. It's so interesting that each of you sort of approach this question on a very personal level and a very pragmatic level. It's not this, you know, sweeping general gestures. It's all very, like, personal, practical, direct. And I think that that's something that a lot of times in arts movements we don't avail ourselves of because it doesn't feel fancy enough or it doesn't feel like I'm an aesthetic smarty pants. It's like, he liked certain people and he loved his kids. You see, that's actually quite meaningful. And I think, you know, Mark, your comment is just kind of blowing me away because I think so much about how the framing of Black incarcerated persons And their transformation is often framed in terms of religion, and of course, Malcolm X being the most famous example of that. But the transformation in a secular way, in a non-denominational way through poetry and poetics is an extraordinary way to continue to have that discussion about how people find themselves confined and search for their own type of freedom, and how that's part of a larger African-American zeitgeist in terms of searching for freedom. And I just think each of you has brought this idea of the particularities of the person and how they become a synecdoche for these larger issues of care, loving kindness, politics, progress, and culture. Are there any other aspects that, given the constraints of times and things, that you want to talk about to sort of extemporize more on when how the personal becomes political and deeply meaningful out for communities?
I'll just say one thing before passing it down, is that, you know, in Buffalo, there is this incredible black arts movement that has not really been studied in any way, like books have not come out about it, but Celeste's next door neighbor in the Willard Park Projects, which is now condemned and a group is trying to save it, his next door neighbor was Ishmael Reed, and Ishmael wrote a blurb for the book. Across the street was Rick James's mother, right? Wow. And Rick James, when he came back from Canada, would come there and practice at the house, right? There's a great memoir by Lucille Clifton talking about her time in Depew on the outskirts of Buffalo, right? That just came out from New York Review of Books, right? And so there's this incredible center that, again, like our community, speaking big literary community, has not taken enough care to really do some work in that area. And I hope some young scholar soon really does that work justice, because it's incredibly important. I mean, just the couple of poets I've mentioned is like an incredible nucleus of work happening in a literally a two block area of one city here in New York City.
I guess something that feels pressing for me is just to focus on, because the theme for this, I'm going to probably not get it quite exactly right, but it's the tradition of black experimental poetics, right? And making sure that we remember that black is more than just African American as well, right? And so that was what I was maybe subtly and maybe not so subtly doing, right? Phyllis Wheatley born in Africa, and then the La Jeunesse with the Caribbean Demotic. And then Jane Cortez, identified as African American, born in the United States. Her first school that she went to was on a Native American reservation, right? Segregated schools meant a lot of things, and had a grandmother who was Filipino. I find that in experimental poetics, outside of Nurbasi Philip and sometimes Kamau Brathwaite, there is a presumption that the experimental needs to use standard English. And needs to be a particular kind of English. And I really want to kind of explode that. And I'm always encouraging when I'm teaching students to use the multiple, because I teach freshman English, right? And in freshman English, you're supposed to use standard English to write your essay. But when I teach creative writing, you speak multiple languages. Everyone speaks multiple languages and can use all of those ranges. And it's so much more fun when we can get to experience those ranges of English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's interesting, Rosamund, because absolutely the black world is not just the United States. It's not even mostly the United States. And so there's a kind of way in which American hegemony ironically filters through black aesthetics outside the United States. It's quite bizarre in some ways, you know. You know, white supremacists doing hip hop. I'm like, do you even know what? Like, what do you? Anyway, but it's like you're really trying, but this is not doing what you think it's doing. But one of the things that also interests me is, and you know, I loved your reading, is and the way that it shifts the ear because of the acclimation that we've had like so far. But those echoes that are Pan-Africanist, those echoes that go around the world. And this is not me. I mean, I'm pretty crunchy granola and red, black, and green. But this is based on my actual experiences being all over the world in different places, including primarily black countries and black ethnicities and groups and areas. And it seems to be not, one of the things that's not particularized is the influence of black arts and aesthetic, irrespective of the majoritarian or minoritarian status of black people in those particular countries. And I just think that this is a super interesting thing. Now, I don't know if this in some ways how the United States sets up the template, but I think that just thinking that through as a possibility expands a whole bunch of different ways in which we could think about stuff, including prison work. You know, what you were talking about, Mark, it made me think, of course, of the legendary Johnny Cash and his performance in prison and his affectation, his association of working with working class and working poor people as well as people who are incarcerated. And how that was recorded, but Archie Shepp was not recorded. And you have to say, what was the point of not recording him? What was the point of that note? See, right. Because you see, that normalizes the notion of an innovative black aesthetics for regular black people who are incarcerated. You see, that's too radical. And the idea that the avant-garde means you separate yourself from your community is completely disavowed with just that footnote. So, I mean, I guess I'm wondering, we're talking about New York school poetics because you can't really separate these things so much, or when we're talking about the aesthetics of poetry, past and present. The centrality of conceptual frameworks of black art in the larger context of American and international aesthetics, it's always to particularize and make small. And that's something that we have to fight against as a community, in my humble opinion. I'm like the worst moderator because I'm not really being very moderate or even aiding, you know? But you know, I can't front and act like I'm objective in this situation. It doesn't matter to me. You know, that's not a thing. So I apologize if I am being extra, but I'm really trying to, I'm holding back. So anyhow, what is there any, let's turn it to the audience, you know? I also wanna raise the chi, like we don't have to act like these things raise don't the matter. Chi. What you say?
Raise the chi.
You know, I heard Chris jump in. It's like, Chris is like, it's revolutionary. That's why I see facts, Chris. So anybody else want to jump in with a comment, an amen, a disagreement? People want to get heated. People want to, you know. That's all right. Yeah, okay. It's a lot. I just want to say, you know, there's power in telling the truth, there's power in being a little bit uncomfortable, and there's power in saying that we have enough confidence in our communities to say, yeah, we can talk about the difficult things and do it with a sense of loving kindness and care, because that's how we're gonna make change, but not by pretending like we're all so extra and have so well read that we don't have to, you know, feel the feelings and deal with the deep things. And I think all of you in each of your ways has done that with such elegance and grace and care. The real care is there. Don't you feel it? Like, this matters to these folks. It's very, very moving. John Ashbery, we have to have a few conversations, man of your time. But, you know, we're in this space because of care. You know what I'm saying? Yes.
I have a question. About the standardization of language. And I'm wondering what the factors you feel like are that have maybe put that pressure on black artists. Because when I think about that kind of standardization, like I wonder if it's like the MFA, you know, like a further standardization that's happening in literature. But I'm wondering if you feel like there are other forces that are at play, particularly for black poets. And if you also think that that's part of larger trends for other kinds of minoritized poets.
Hmm. I'll tell you one story I was telling Mark over lunch. Mark and I were involved with the publication of Kamau Brathwaite's book, Conversations with Nathaniel Mackey, in 1999. And all well and good. Brathwaite, we mentioned earlier, he published this book with the small off the, grid press because New Directions wouldn't publish it. Why wouldn't New Directions publish it? Sycorax video style. And Kamau wanted it to be 8.5 by 11, which is not convenient for distribution. Or so he turns to us, we do it. Very sweet. Now Norton wants to publish parts of this book.
Huh.
And I have the rights to this, sort of nominally to this, to make the editorial decisions on the reprints. And they can't get it right. So this idea of standardization of language, if you step outside the right size, the right kind of typography, because that's you, you have trouble. And I think I can think of it. You mentioned a couple of examples of writers who, we're supposed to write in a certain way, but no, the people we really love don't have to write that way, I think. But anyway, I thought it was interesting. I mean, this is ongoing, this problem of getting the work out there the way it's supposed to be. We're not going to let Norton publish it in Times New Roman, like looking like, like Robert Frost or whoever. It has to be the Sycorax video style because that was a polemical force for Kamau. I'm sure you guys have other things to say.
Can I just say one thing, too?
Wait, let's get the mic so we can get it.
Sorry about that. What's interesting about that, too, is like you talking about the imprimatur that you put on Kamau Braithwaite's work, and now Born to Slow Horses comes out in what, like 2005? So, I do wonder how much whiteness's role in shaping literature through publishing, but then again through the MFA, is like deciding which black experiments exist at all.
We didn't do anything. We did exactly, took the pages Kamau gave us, made plates of them, published the book. End of story, no editorializing, So that's why he liked it, And he did so many things on his own because no one else was going to do what he did. And, I mean, DIY exists across cultures and across...
When we published Weatherly's short history... He wanted it to look like a CD case. So we had the designer do it. And you got a small press. You can do what you can do because you don't have to worry about standard publishing games at all. I upped the small press for sure because why would you want not to? John himself never failed to give books to small presses. No matter how big a deal was going on, there was always a new small press book coming out. So then an artist or a designer or a small publisher could get the work out in the most beautiful and timely forms. So really, support your local small presses because we do that. And yeah.
I think since regarding whiteness, maybe Claudia Rankine's definition of whiteness, I think it's so common for people to be reductive about what is black experimental poetry like, instead of being like there's Giovanni Singleton, which is not Erica Hunt, which is not Harriet Mullen, right? So I think that it's good to stay conscious of how maybe industry, including us, can like subtract from celebrating this wideness.
Yeah, I noticed in your questions a couple of times you have leaned into the question about the MFA. And since I teach in Iowa...
I have a couple things to say about the MFA.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, how our comments will counterpoint, because I teach at a school where there's an MFA program. I don't teach in the MFA program. I'm not considered qualified to teach in the MFA program.
I met Harriet Mullen when I was an undergraduate. I stumbled upon one of her books, and I went to her office at hours, and I said, please, teach me how to write poetry. And she said, I'm not allowed. Harriet Mullen teaches at an institution that does not have an MFA program. Okay, so there's there's all of that. I don't know a whole lot about MFAs. I don't have one. I don't teach in one right now. That may change in the future. They seem to be, you know, they seem to be changing their minds. I'm not sure I want to teach for them now. I teach in the BFA program. So there's all of that. There's also, when we're talking about what counts as Black experimental poetics, it's also what counts as Black poetry, right? And then when we move beyond what's taught, there's also what is accessible as Black poetry. So when I go to the slam competitions in Trinidad, they sound like they're from Brooklyn because they're Googling stuff on the internet. That's very frustrating to me. When I go to the Gambia, it's the same thing, you know? And there are beautiful poets from Brooklyn, but I don't want them to sound just like you. I don't want them to sound just like, you know, old reruns from Deaf Poetry Jam, right? And it's one of the reasons why I've started doing what I call, for myself, the V book. I make these videos of me reading my work, and I put them online for free. So if folks are interested in my work, they don't have to buy the book. They don't even have to read it. They can experience it in different ways. And so I think all of the things are all of the things to make sure that folks are exposed. You know, when I teach Nabezi Philip, I don't teach her as experimental writing. I teach her as poetry. And on any given day, a third of the class is, what the hell is this? I didn't know how to read it. I don't understand it. And a third of the class is like, it's all right. And then a third of the class says, this makes complete sense to me. This is the story of my life. If you tell them that it's strange, that's a whole different conversation. But if you just present it as, we got this kind of poetry, we got this kind of poetry, it's all poetry, it's, you know, you're gonna like some of it, you're not gonna like some of it. So I think everyone needs to kind of step up their game in different ways, including us as poets ourselves. If we want people to experience our work, we might need to think about different ways of putting it out in the world.
Yeah. Out in the world is such a thing. I had a student, I just have retired from 30 years teaching the same demographic over and over at the United States Merchant Marine Academy. We taught sailors, but every now and then somebody would come in who wasn't one of the guys who looked like all the other guys, and I had a kid from American Samoa, and his name was Puamve. Those were the first three syllables. There were like 20 other syllables that he just didn't let anybody bother with. He wanted an independent study in hip-hop, history of hip-hop, for me, because I was the only one who teach an independent study in anything that anybody wanted. So I said, you're going to have to teach me. And luckily, that was just when the comic book was coming out. So we used that. That was our text. There's a huge history of hip-hop, comic book. And I learned as much as I could, as fast as I could. But he brought in, and he wrote. That's what he wrote. And I said, how in Samoa is this what you found? He said, everybody does this where I grew up, because this is what we listen to on the internet. And he said, this is our culture. So if anybody's interested in Samoan language hip hop, that too is out there. And this is the yeasty interculturalizations that you can get behind, because that's what's there. It's what it is. Mm-hmm. And you can find out about it. You know, that's just a tiny thing. But why would you not teach that to people if you could find it? Because it's like going to a market where all the flavors are available. Why would you just stick to McDonald's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it. I personally think, Rosamund, since you asked specifically why, I think that's changing, and we also sometimes need to know when we're winning. You know, I mean, honestly. 20 years ago, the idea of me teaching at Iowa would have been ridiculous. you know. But you know, we saw the same thing with the beat poets. And you can find one of those old Norton anthologies when they literally said, talked about Allen Ginsberg's sexual bent, like at the wrist of some bull. Like things change. And I think there's a lot of factors for that change. I think Buffalo's PhD program is a huge factor in that change. I think people's ears changing because of hip hop was a huge factor in that change. So I think the MFA programs are changing as they do. And I've always found it's kind of like in a corporate structure. Sometimes it's not the top people that are the worst. It's like the middle management. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, I want to show the boss that I can really be a jerk, right? Sometimes it's like the striving. It's like the, and so, you know, I see these shifts because of Iowa. And I think those things will be a reality in a lot of ways because top dogs want to stay the top dog. They don't want to be last. But I think, you know, there are probably some MFA programs that's like, I would never teach that. I don't want anything to do with that because that's not the standard. And we want to be like X, Y, and Z. Meanwhile, the X, Y, and Z are like, yeah, we got to keep it fresh because we want the best of the best from all over the world. So it's just kind of interesting how that's shaking out. Like, I'm talking about my lived experience. I'm not talking, you know, it's not theory. And it's, I also did the work in other ways. Like, I'm not against standard poetry, which is a misunderstanding people think, you know. I say, no, we always pay attention to the convention. The convention doesn't pay attention to us. We always, you know, that's the difference. But, you know, it's like we're still talking about 14 people, so, like, we can't have beef and, like, different gangs. It's like, how are you going to have a gang? First of all, we're all nerds. Second of all, it's like 12 people. It's, like, ridiculous. Oh, there's 12 slam poets, and there's, like, 7 new school poets. And it's like you're still talking about, like, the dozens. Not the dozens, but, like, dozens. Not really, but you know what I'm saying. But I think that what it is the palpable nature of standardization, but also the impact of language. And poetry is a particular thing. Nobody goes into poetry for the money. It still has, and I think we should realize this, an exalted place in society all over the world. And that's why its continued innovation brings out the best and the worst of us, but also its deep meaningfulness. And that I continue to see that reflected in Iowa and other elite programs, and I think it will filter over and into not only other MFA programs, but places like prison and people out completely outside of the matrix of conventional academia. And therefore, I'm hopeful. It's a pragmatic hopefulness because people refuse to not make poetry meaningful. It will always be meaningful. That's what I believe. So anyway, if you're asking my opinion. Any other questions or comments? Emily, I see you amening with your energy. Do you have a comment? Scholar Emily?
We're all wonderful.
I see. All right, Emily, I see your dope hoop earrings, and I say that that is a good way to conclude. And I want to thank this passionate and caring panel for their deeply thoughtful and caring contribution to our discussions today. Now we're going to take a break.
Thank you all so much. Those listening at home, we're going to end the stream for today. We'll be back tomorrow morning. And those who can be here, we have our night of performance. Doors open at 7:30. Show is at 8. Some amazing stuff happening this evening. Don't miss it. Thank you all.